This program is part of Full Service Radio, an internet radio station and podcast network with over 32 weekly shows broadcasting from the lobby of the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. All of our hosts are Washington, D.C. locals, covering stuff like music, arts, culture, identity, politics, and so much more. Visit fullserviceradio.org for all of our programming and enjoy the show. Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit www.simplecast.com. That's simplecast.com.
All right, now you can hear me. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We're here on the, this is great, we're on Full Service Radio. We're global.
Yes,
so I global. Want to say hi to all my friends and my fans, big fans in Guam mm-hmm. and Antarctica. I hope they're listening.
Important.
Important. And mm-hmm. we're, okay, so Nikki and I have a show called Foodie and the Beast. It has been on broadcast radio for 9 years. It's a food and wine variety show. We have on chefs, we have on marine biologists, we have on cookbook authors, you name it, anybody related to the food chain, to raising food, to cooking food, mm-hmm. to writing or talking about it. But that show's kind of a quick hit. Everybody gets about 7 minutes.
It's a party. It's always a party.
And a lot of booze, mm-hmm. and then we kick them off.
Yes, pretty
and
much.
And we stay on. This show is a little bit more of a deep dive into somewhat more substantive and serious subjects, sometimes.
Sometimes.
And
we're going to keep it light. We don't have to make it super heavy.
How do you talk about what we're going to talk about?
Okay, well, this is super right. heavy. All but right. there's an upside to the end of what we're talking about because there's affect and effect. So there's a silver lining to what we're talking
all
about
right.
today.
You lost me at affect and effect, but why don't you tell them what we're talking about?
Okay, so while the sexual harassment epidemic is in Hollywood and competitive sports and other industries, it's making headlines every day. Today, too. Somebody's getting called out every day. But quite frankly, just guess any woman who's worked in a kitchen and they know what the dirty little secret is in the restaurant industry. Whether, you know, we've had the women's movement and anti-discrimination laws and corporate sexual harassment training, like all those things are in existence, but it has not waylaid the problem of sexual harassment in the restaurant industry. And so what we're going to do today is talk about where we are now, because after the big Harvey Weinstein break, we've had a lot of names come out specifically in the restaurant industry, from Mario Batali to Ken Friedman to John Besh. So now that we have all this, where are we now and what do we do next? And we have some interesting facts about the restaurant industry.
Why don't we set the playing field for
a minute? Okay, go ahead.
So we did a little research. Hard to believe, but we did. 13 million restaurant workers nationwide. 13 million Americans are involved in the restaurant industry. Of that, 7% are women.
71%.
No, excuse me, 71% are women. I'm sorry, I jumped ahead on my things.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all of those women, well, actually, I got a different number here, but 37% of all sexual harassment claims filed with the EEO are from women.
Yes.
So women are the targets.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, lots of people are targets, but women are a huge target.
Right, and mm-hmm. and I think one of the things we found is that a lot of that is because they're low-wage workers. Many of them are waitresses,
mm-hmm.
and they're dependent on tips to really make money and keep going and feed themselves and their families and their kids.
Right.
And they're vulnerable because if a customer's harassing you or your boss is harassing you, do you really want to risk getting fired and losing your money?
Well, I think you're jumping ahead because we're going to get to that, because it's not just servers in the restaurant industry that we're talking about.
No, we're talking about any
woman in the
industry.
We're talking about women in the industry in general. So why don't you introduce I'm going to introduce our first guest. So a couple of months ago, back in November, when all this was really breaking, I had the honor of sitting on a panel and moderating it for Women Chefs and Restaurateurs and Les Dames Escoffier, two fabulous women chef based and restaurant industry women's groups. And it was, does the restaurant industry have a Harvey Weinstein problem? Which seems like a silly question, because of course the answer is yes. And Ruth Gresser was on the panel with me, and she just really blew everybody away with her information. Ruth Gresser, if you don't know, is the owner of the Pizzeria Paradiso's at Around Town, Alexandria, DuPont, and Georgetown. Thank you.
And Hyattsville.
Oh, my God, you have four.
Today, Washington. Tomorrow's Zavarro.
Right. And you just opened up the game room, which we're going to find out about a little later. But she has been in the industry, and I feel bad saying this because I felt like I said this an awful lot before, but you've been in the industry for 40 years.
Yep.
So you've really seen it all. So we're going to be talking with Ruth about what she's seen, what she knows, because she knows all about the history of the chef's coat and the brigade and how the system works and how she runs her restaurants based on that.
All right, and also with us is an old friend from Foodie and the Beast as well, and that's Catherine Miller. Catherine's the founding executive director of the Chef Action Network, but she's also senior director of policy and advocacy at the James Beard Foundation, where she oversees a number of programs. And the James Beard Foundation has come up more and more because the question is, what is the preeminent organization that stands for the industry? What is their involvement in, and what are they doing to protect workers from sexual harassment? So we're going to find out more about that.
And lastly,
we're
going to have something to drink, because we're all going to need something to drink when we're talking about sexual harassment.
We always drink. So Drew McCormick is the executive beverage director. What a title. For Ruth Gresser at Pizzeria Paradiso in the game room. And actually, you're a beer person, and we're here to talk beer, but let's start with you a little. I mean, what's it like to be a woman, particularly when you talk beer, you think of, you know, guys in Budweiser hats tailgating. So what's it like to be a woman in a largely male-dominated segment of the industry?
I mean, I think the first thing you think about with beer and women is sex sells and the, you know,
St. Pauli's girl
swimsuit model on the commercials, and which is still very much true. So taking that and transitioning it into a profession where you're a woman who's in charge of a beer program.
And being taken seriously.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult. I think a lot of times my name being Drew is also confusing for people.
Just a little bit.
So they assume they've been emailing back and forth with a man. Not only because of my name, but because of my position. And then they walk through the door and it's me.
Are you talking about customers, reps, or other people in the industry?
Or is the answer yes?
Yes to all of it.
Really. I don't email back and forth so much with customers, so that example doesn't apply. But I think if any of my staff is talking about our beer director or our beverage director, people often jump to male in their mind.
Do you get challenged a lot by male customers on your beer knowledge? Like, is there a gauntlet thrown because you're a woman?
A little bit. I mean, I think the assumption is more that I don't drink beer, or that it, you know,
I'm a stereotype.
That's what Phil just said to me the other day.
Wait, you got to talk into the mic.
Sorry. I was just talking with someone in the industry, and he said to me, "You don't drink beer, do you?"
And seriously?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I am a stereotype. Yeah. I don't really drink beer. I'll taste it, but it's not something I order. But
I'm a stereotype. I drink all the beer that anybody gives me.
Yes, exactly. That's also true.
So do I.
Okay, so let's talk about the first beer you brought today.
Okay, so this is a beer from Denizens. Mm-hmm. It's called Third Party Triple.
They're out of Silver Spring, right?
They are out of Silver Spring. Mm-hmm.
They're on East-West Highway Extended, almost to Georgia Avenue in Silver Spring.
Correct.
That's where they are.
And it's made by a woman.
So it's majority female owned. Mm-hmm. They have three owners, two women and one gentleman. His name is Jeff. He's great. And I think we've worked with Denizens quite a bit. We brewed a collaboration beer with them called The Gruit Made Me Do It. And we've worked quite a bit with them. And I think Julie, who's one of the owners, is someone I hold near and dear.
She's a big force on the BC beer scene.
Especially in the...
everybody
for women
has
in the beer industry.
Exactly. So what'd you bring today?
So this is their third-party triple. Mm-hmm. It's in a lovely can. They just did a little rebranding, so the imagery is looking very nice. We have this at the game room. Mm-hmm. Everybody's looking for it.
And what are the flavors? What are we looking for with
this? So it's like slightly sweet, little effervescent, nice prickly carbonation. It's got like a little bit of an herbaceous thing. I brought the Siciliana pizza to...
Which is delicious. I think that's going to go with anything.
I agree.
Right?
Mine went with anything.
Right, you finished it.
So the Siciliana is my favorite on the menu pizza item.
Excellent. All right. Well, we're going to come back to you in a little bit because you brought another beer also made by a woman brewer. And then later in the show, we'll bring everybody in to sort of talk about our experiences and where we are with the sexual harassment in the restaurant industry. But Ruth, I really want to start with you. When we sat on that panel, you said to me before we got up there, I'm wearing my chef's coat, and there's a reason, and that's the first question I want you to ask me. And you're in today with your chef's coat on. So, Ruth, why are you wearing your chef's coat?
Well, I'm wearing my chef's coat because I'm a chef.
Right.
but the thing to note about the chef's coat is that it's modeled after a military uniform. And that was developed when cooking became professionalized. And when cooking went from being the domain of women, cooking mostly in the home, but also to a greater public, but mostly in the home, and it was professionalized, it had to become masculinized, because suddenly something that was basically didn't receive any compensation, had to have some kind of value. And the only way that it could have value for men as a profession is if it was somehow separated from what women did. And one way to masculinize is to model things after the military, because the military was made up of men. Mm-hmm. And so the uniform that was developed was based on a military model. The hierarchy of kitchens was based on the military model.
Can you explain that a little bit? Because I don't, for people who love the restaurant industry but aren't in it, they may not understand the brigade system and how it is done in the back of the house.
Sure. Well, there's the chef mm-hmm. at the top. And the chef is the French word for chief, so mm-hmm. similar to like general or commander. Chef is never called by their name. They're only called chef. So as I kind of analyze it, it's almost a deification. There's an authority that is not to be questioned in the position of chef, similar to the military. And then there were stations, and the hierarchy, you came in as an apprentice and worked for years without pay. Mm-hmm. And then you slowly, moved up the ranks, similar to a military system.
Hmm. Interesting. And then what about around the kitchen? I mean, when we talk about the ranks, how do you slowly move up and how does that affect women now?
Well, there's certainly the hierarchy authority, let's call it. So the stations begin at the low level of prep.
Right.
And then you move from prep to cold station to hot station. There's the grill station there. In large kitchens, there's the grill station, the meat station, the fish station, all of these different, and it's a progression.
Okay.
And the most, the grill or the meat station is generally considered the most
desired position.
Yeah, the one with the most esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, it's kind of has that male kind of
I grill
feel
meat.
About
I take care
it.
Of the
yeah,
meat.
It's
right.
hot. It's you get burns and
they're
knives. Right. And then there's off to the side kind of are the saucier and mm-hmm. so which to my mind is much more of an important position than who's grilling the steak. But there is the progression, and women generally it takes much longer to move up.
Well, you've been in the industry for all this time. When you started, mm-hmm. what were the blocks that were put in front of you?
What were the blocks that were put in front of me? We can start with my first job. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, for whatever reason, I didn't follow the normal course. Because my first job in the restaurant business was when I was 17 and I got a job at McDonald's. And at that time, we all wore polyester, and women worked the counter and men worked the grill. That's just the way it was set up. And for some reason, I was hired and I was put in the kitchen. And I can't tell you why that was, but somebody knew something that I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. So that would...
It was McDonald's. Maybe they thought you had a death wish. You don't know.
So I immediately... I mean, my course was immediately different than other people's. But one of the early jobs that I had was at a restaurant in Pennsylvania. And it was a job in a kitchen in a hotel. And I lived with the family that owned the hotel in their home. And, you know, the husband, father, boss started to make advances at me. And this would have been in the late 70s, so I didn't even know the term sexual harassment.
Sure.
So the end of that story is I left rather than dealing with the situation. And that, I think, is the way that I dealt with everything that was put in front of me, is if things didn't move the way I wanted them to, I left and tried someplace else. But that's my story.
Right, of course. You know? Well, everybody has their own story.
Right, right.
And as you evolved and came to, you know, Pizzeria Paradiso, which mm-hmm. opened...
1991.
Right.
26
years ago. Mm-hmm. Were there things that you were like, I don't want this in my yeah. restaurant? I mean, did you know that when you opened? Because yeah. I feel like there were things in 1991 that we all sort of shrugged yeah. at. We were like, well, that's the way it
yeah.
is.
I did not want to work in a place where everybody yelled at each other, mm-hmm. which is common, you know, that's just standard. I did not want a place where people worked themselves beyond, you know, we had 40-hour work weeks. That's what we worked.
So rare back in yeah. 1991.
Yeah. I did not want a restaurant where the kitchen didn't have a good relationship with the dining room. And then again, and that goes back to this authority that is supposed to, you know, sit with the chef. And
right. Well, because I think for a long time, the front of the house and the back of the house were like against each other,
yeah.
right? They
yeah.
didn't work together, which right. seems so ridiculous for the success yes, of the right? restaurant.
Let me ask you a question. Did you think at that point, I mean, that you needed to impose a sexual harassment sort of
I don't think people were saying sexual harassment
yeah,
they, in 1991.
Whatever, yeah. where you said to the boys, don't mess with the girls, and you said to the boys, don't mess with the boys, and girls, you know, I mean...
You know, I've never said, well, I shouldn't say never, but I've rarely had to speak that. You know, I mean...
But you built a culture of respect.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, right. we treated each other...
Catherine, you got to get on that.
Sorry,
mic.
Yeah. You got to speak right in front of the mic. That's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I am a respectful person, mm-hmm. and so the culture that developed immediately when we opened was one of mutual respect for, you know, across the board.
Well, I just want to back up a bit to what you said earlier, because I think one of the things people think of when they think of the restaurant industry is this yelling, screaming culture, Gordon Ramsay, you know, screaming at everybody, whether you're male or female.
Right.
And, you know, when Anthony Bourdain, while he's stepped away from Kitchen Confidential, you know, that book was a basic misogynist Bible
right.
to the back of the house. And, you know, now he's like, I didn't mean to create a bro culture. But
well, they all say that.
The
yeah.
culture right. was already there.
When you get
yeah.
caught.
Well,
you yeah.
the culture was there, but also remembering that we're just getting to a tipping point where women are more in power in positions of power as chefs and restaurant owners than we have been ever before, right? We are really at this point. I mean, Ruth, chefs like you and Mary Sue Milliken and others created new cultures for their kitchens, but we're also kind of rare birds,
right?
Right?
Well, Catherine, why don't we introduce you a little bit more and tell us more about sort of your Chef Action Network and now it's working with the James Beard Foundation.
Yeah, so the Chef Action Network was a program that was built off the Chef's Boot Camp for Policy and Change, which was an initiative by the James Beard Foundation to train chefs to be better public policy advocates. And we started a nonprofit to help continue that work, right? So we have about 200 chefs that have gone through that program around the country. I tend to think they're some of the most enlightened in many ways about different cultures and issues and how to create that. And really the people that we've been hearing most from. In the last 2 years, we've taken that work actually inside of the James Beard Foundation, which has been part of the overall genesis and of the foundation to look more at things around impact, right? How do we create a diverse, sustainable food world for everybody, right? That culture, and culture is a big piece of that for, I think, for us and for everyone. And, you know, we're now at a point where the majority of people graduating from culinary schools, where they still teach the brigade system.
Right.
Right. That culinary curriculum has not changed in over 100 years.
And not only that, it's not just the brigade system. I mean, there is a level of fear at those culinary schools, even the CIA, which, I mean, is gorgeous and fabulous and is very helpful to its students. There is that yes chef mentality. Yeah. There is a level of fear of your superiors at the school.
Well, I mean, this is a $1 trillion industry that we're talking about. And so if we think about chefs and restaurateurs in the same way that we think about venture capital firms or other corporate CEOs, the idea of a lack of culture to support both employees but also employers, which is more in the vein of sort of human connection and treating people the way you want to be treated. I mean, the large majority of some of the most successful restaurant groups are those that have created positive cultures. Now, certainly we've seen within this movement of Me Too and Time's Up, the shining the spotlight on those that don't have that culture.
John Besh is a great example. Do you know what I mean? He wasn't minding his store and he allowed the people in his kitchens to behave badly, and they had HR and they weren't doing anything about it. But then you have Mario Batali, who was just behaving badly. And I don't know how that affected the culture in his restaurants, but we know what he did. So I think, you know, we've got two issues here when we're dealing with sexual harassment in this industry and any industry, really. We're dealing either, some people are just assholes. Do you know what I mean? They're assholes, and some people are predators. And sometimes they're both. But that's one of the things I think is going to be the most difficult to deal with in any industry when we're talking about, you know, a cultural shift.
Well, I think we're also talking about power shift dynamics.
Yes.
I mean, this isn't, I think, and Bruce said this earlier to me too, and it's something that I talk about all the time. If we put this into the vein of sex and sexuality and all of those things, and not in its proper place, whether you're talking about anywhere from the spectrum of harassment to rape, you're talking about crimes of power.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's not sexy. That's what rape is. Rape is a crime of power and, you know, the assertion of power. And I think that probably describes it better back in the kitchen than anything else. I mean, listen, we have a president who thinks that way. So it's not hard to think of a chef or even a cook in a diner who's kind of in charge, feeling entitled and empowered. I mean, I had a business partner who is no longer on this earth, who was the guy who would come in and stand behind the young girls who were, you know, the account executives, and he would massage their shoulders and how are you and that kind of stuff. And he just felt like it was his domain and he was king.
Yeah, but we also have to, as employers and restaurateurs and employers in any culture, in any employment situation, we have to make sure that we're creating an atmosphere where, you know what, if you don't want that shoulder rub, you feel okay, A, saying to the person who gave it to you, hey, I don't really like the shoulder rub.
Yeah,
buddy.
Please don't do that again.
Please don't do that again.
Right.
Right. And if that person continues to do that, then you say to your boss, hey, Joe over here won't stop massaging my shoulders.
Yeah, but if that is your boss, then there needs to be...
But then it's a whole other thing, right? But you have to create an atmosphere by which people feel comfortable just being like, dude, stop giving me a massage.
Right.
It starts long before you even get into the position.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when we were talking before, and I said when I would come up against something that was uncomfortable to me in whatever way, in whatever job I had, I would leave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I am a person who can do that.
Right.
But there are most women particularly can't do that for either, you know, because of the situation that they're responsible for feeding a family, and also just personally, women are not taught their own power. No. You know, from the time they're little girls.
No, we're taught. No,
I think my wife must have had private instruction in that.
Well, we're not going to go there.
Yeah, see these stooped shoulders.
No. It'd be like getting into an argument with my father. Yeah. I'm not doing that.
No. We are taught to accommodate.
Yes,
we are taught to also... Mm-hmm.
Ignore.
Not necessarily ignore, but if we're going to get out of a situation, we're going to do it in a way that doesn't upset the person who's doing it, mm-hmm, right? So mm-hmm. We want to do it in a way, because the worst thing is for a woman, when you say to somebody who's making you uncomfortable, "You're making me feel uncomfortable," and they're like, "Oh, don't think so great about you." Like, "I'm not doing that. I'm not flirting with you. I'm not hitting on you."
Right.
You know, then you're, you know what's happening.
But right. That's a perfect segue to talking about the people that I'm thinking may be the most at risk in the restaurant arena, and that's waitresses, because they're
servers.
Sorry, what did I? Is that a bad word?
No, I'm just saying.
Okay. I don't want to get in trouble. Good Lord.
Okay.
But because they're told to dress a certain way, because that'll encourage customers to
in some restaurants.
But if you know that old line about the customer is always right, is asserted by the restaurant management, by the owner and right. the GM and the AGM, then a server is kind of, you know, what do I do? Do I react to this? Do I stand up for myself, or do I just suck it up and go along because A, I need the tip, and B, I need the job? So,
yeah, well, I don't think that the server's any different than the kitchen, frankly. I mean, I guess you can get it from...
I think the reason why the server has been called out specifically, like in all the articles and all the studies that have been coming out over the last couple of weeks, is because the server could conceivably get it
from both sides.
From right. the customer yeah. and yeah.
From the manager, from the dishwasher.
Like it can right. be, they always have to accommodate because that's their role.
Okay, speaking of getting it from all sides, I just saw a sign that said take a break. So we're going to go to a commercial because we got to pay for the show, and we'll be right back with Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast.
Original music here on the break. It's called Let's Go West, and it's by Kiedo, K-I-E-D-O. Find him on soundcloud.com/Kiedo. Again, thank you to Simplecast, simplecast.com for more on them. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We're live.
That music makes it sound like an easy listening station, doesn't it, kind of?
A little bit.
We're not easy listening. This is a tough subject.
Yes. Well, we are live at the Lion Hotel, and we're sitting here today with Ruth Bresser of Pizzeria Paradiso, Catherine Miller of the Chef Action Network and James Beard Foundation, and Drew McCormick, who is the beverage director over
executive beverage director.
Director.
Sorry, better get it right, Missy.
Yes, no, that's exactly true. So, Drew, first we want you brought another beer produced by a woman.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about it?
So this is from Grimm. It's called Rainbow Dome. It's a dry hopped sour with some apricots in it.
Mm-hmm. Where's it out of?
So Grimm is from, they're out of Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Formerly what we would call a gypsy brewer, so with no official brewery site that you would think of.
Well, I got a question for you, because I'm not a big sour beer guy. We have a son who's in your industry who loves sours, and he drinks them.
I just want to say that my husband just took my pizza.
I did.
But go ahead.
Well, that's my
point.
I
know. There's lots of delicious pizza to go with this beer in studio.
Back off. Back down.
Sorry.
Okay. I'm doing it to make a point.
Okay.
Because for me, sours are more palatable if there's food involved.
Yeah.
Is that, are they meant to be? I mean, I'm sure you can drink them any way you want. You can probably take them, intravenously, but is it created to augment food or be augmented by food? Or
I mean, she's what like, was not really.
I think all of the above would be true. I think the thing about sours that works particularly with pizza is the cheese factor. So it cuts a little bit of the harshness of that sour flavor. You don't get as much like pain in the back of your
jaw.
Can't
you tell that I'm full of cheese already?
Yeah. Oh my God, don't laugh.
I love
that.
Sours with food and without food, but it's definitely a little
sour.
Different.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
A little sour.
Also, Drew, we were talking earlier with you about, you know, what it's like to be a female in as a beverage director, but specifically with a passion for beer and working, you know, with your knowledge of beer and how hard that is, because beer is typically considered a man's world, although that is changing with the craft beer scene. But what has your experience been? I mean, you said off air that you had a server story. Is this something you want to share?
Yeah. So I worked at a seafood seasonal restaurant for a long time in Maine,
mm-hmm.
Which was very much the classic sort of men worked in the kitchen. We had valets, which were always men because women are bad drivers. So just all of these sort of stereotypes that were reinforced, and it was that culture created. And then I think a total 180 was coming down to Paradiso, and we talk a lot about Ruth and the environment that she's created, and she's created a good place to work. But beyond that, the culture of feeling like you can stand up for yourself and speak up for yourself. I think it was my second real official shift as a server. I had a little banter back and forth with a gentleman.
Do we want to call him a customer?
Yeah, a customer.
Okay, a customer.
And you can feel it. You get that feeling when it starts to approach inappropriate, and it moves from banter to inappropriate. And he crossed the line, and I looked at him and said, if you speak to me like that again, I'm going to have to ask you to leave. And then immediately turned around from the table and was like, crap, 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 you know, like, oh, God, am I going to get fired? Is this guy a regular? What's going on? Who, you know. And then, you know, a few days later, after realizing the place that I was working, I realized how silly it was to have that concern.
I mean, did he come back at you, or did he say anything, or did he just shut up?
No, that was kind of the end of it.
Well, but I think, Ruth, I mean, the question is that how do you balance in the restaurant world the customer is always right with keeping your employees safe?
I think the customer is always right, except when they're not.
Right.
And we have a pretty high bar, I think. Mm-hmm. And all restaurants have a pretty high bar of what, you know, where it is that you're going to step that is not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I've said for years and years and years, our answer is yes. Our answer is always yes. If a customer wants something and we can do it, the answer is yes. But there are things we can't do. And one thing that we can't do is be abused or insulted or assaulted. And so, as Drew said, you just know when that line's about to be crossed.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, from Drew's story, the thing that I take from it that is so powerful is that she stopped it. She stopped it before he went there.
Right,
you
which
know?
Is really amazing for you, Drew.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, there are women who do not feel empowered to do that.
For me, when I was 16, working in a seasonal seafood restaurant, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And then you grow and you exist in an environment where that's acceptable and almost expected.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to say that there's 30 years between me and Drew.
Okay.
And so when we talk about the feminist movement of the 70s, I mean, that's 40 plus years ago.
I know, and we're here.
And we're here still dealing with the same thing. And I hope that you're right. I hope that this is a tipping point. You know, there's so much that has to change
well,
so fundamentally.
The question is who will the leaders be, right? First mm-hmm. of all, as women, now, we have women here who all support each other, but I think we can all talk to experiences with women bosses or women who were above us who did not support us, who did not want to raise us. And I think personally, I'm doing everything in my power with the women who work for me to make sure that they're getting raised, that they are being empowered, and that their goals are set high to be in positions of power. Because I think part of the issue was when, like, my first job was with a woman boss who she was fabulous, but she was sort of like, I had to deal with that, so do you. Instead of being like, screw that, we're not dealing with that shit anymore. And I think that's what needs to be said, not just by women in power, but by the men we work next to as well. So the question is how do we have to bring them on board in order to, you know, get to that next level.
All right, let me jump in and ask Catherine about the Beard Foundation and what, I mean, this is all happening so fast, I honestly don't know if anything is sort of coalesced behind the four walls of the Beard Foundation to say, we're gonna focus on doing this, or let's initiate that. What goes on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think this has been a very real discussion for us. Andy Quintrano, who's in Atlanta, Bacchanalia and Star Provisions, is the chair of our awards committee. That has been the place where we've mostly heard a lot of comments, right? People who would love for the Beard Foundation to come out and take people's awards away, right? And, you know, our awards system is completely independent of the foundation. I know that people love to think that there's a bunch of staff members sitting there with their pens and their cards, but that's not actually how it happens. There's 700 plus independent voters. They're journalists. They're former winners. And this year,
do you think that's really the solution?
Well, I'm
asking you, is that a way to go?
That's certainly a call that some people have said. Past award winners have said that they have a challenge being associated with the folks that have won. I think what the awards committee is looking for is something to remind voters, which it has done officially, Annie's leading that charge in an amazing way, to say that in addition to food and ambiance, you should think about culture, right? Well, you should think about how a business is run. And really going to those 700 members of the awards committee, the journalists, the past winners, the food industry professionals, and saying, hey, this season is coming up. We're about to be in this season. And the interesting thing for me is, I think Pete Wells said it in one of his stories, there's 66,000 restaurants in the country.
Right. It's hard to crawl them all. It's hard to know about all of them.
And how do you know about all of
them? Well, not only that. I think it's, I mean, take John Besh, who had a great reputation, who's a James Beard Award winner, right?
Yep.
To go back and retroactively take his award because he turned out to be scuzzy, or reputedly scuzzy, to me is like, okay, you know, it doesn't make sense. It's like it's all too much in the past. Then you have a challenge, and it's a real challenge, because if you're basically just going on reputation, and I think where there's smoke, there's fire. I don't have any question that our president meant what he said on that bus. He wasn't just doing locker room. I never heard that talked about in a locker room, and I've been in plenty. So, but I mean, how do you weigh that? You know, if you weigh kind of reputation,
going forward,
you know, to take that into consideration, because some of it's innuendo and some of it can't be really grounded in anything.
There's no quantitative measure,
right?
With the exception of potential legal actions and court measures and that kind of stuff. I think one of the interesting things that has happened over the last few months, whether it be in industry, whether it be in Hollywood, whether it be in the restaurants, whether it be in financial institutions, that the real question is, one, do we support those people who come forward? Do we listen to that stuff and treat it not just as gossip and innuendo, but hey, is there fire where there's smoke?
Right.
And how do we do that? And that is not the role of the James Beard Foundation. That is the role of the industry itself. That's the role of the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission. That's the role of HR folks. But I think that what our awards committee has said and what our members have said is we would love for the awards committee to take a look beyond that, right? Mm-hmm. Just take a look beyond just food and ambiance and make sure. I mean, what I'm excited about is there's a new organization called Good Food 100, which is a nascent organization that uses quantitative measures related to food sourcing. And they've just added questions about restaurant culture in their new survey for this upcoming year, right? So we're going to start to get quantitative best practices, examples of all
that.
Well,
I have to be honest, and I'm sure, I mean, listen, there are literally thousands of articles to read right now as we were preparing for this. I mean, I didn't want to send you all links to like 100 articles. I'm sure you've read half of them, but there's just so much information out there right now. And I think that we spend so much time in the media world talking about, you know, did our pig grow up on a farm, and was he well cared for, and was he humanely killed, and where did our vegetables come from, and are they organic? We should care as much, not just about the food on our plate, but how the people are treated in that establishment.
That's what I was going to say. You know, I mean, if you start with the idea that it, and you're promulgating the idea that it's, that every restaurant manager, owner should say to his or her people, the customer isn't always right. The customer's right up to a point, and then the customer's full of shit. And you have to step to the customer and not try and, you know, mollify him or her if you're being harassed. But the other thing is, there isn't one big guiding... The Beard Foundation, in my head, because I'm a layperson, is like, you know, God in heaven to the restaurant industry. Somewhere along the line, somebody ought to create guidelines that if you want to be a member of, whether it's your organization or the restaurant association or whatever, these aren't just the guidelines to be followed. You have to have sensitivity training in your restaurants. If it's quarterly for an hour where people get it and they're reminded that, you know, even if you're scoffing at this, you know, behind your eyeballs, if you harass your coworkers, and we haven't talked about gay coworkers who might be harassed as well, if you harass your coworkers sexually or any other way, you bully them, you're going to pay.
Well, that goes back to, should we take away their awards? Because what are the consequences? You know, real consequences. And there's a lot of, but there's a lot of symbolism in saying, okay, we're taking this from you. You got this under circumstances we were unaware, and now we're taking it back. I don't know that it's necessary, but the reality is this stuff goes on with no consequences. Mm-hmm. And the question is, are we ready to now have consequences? And whether it's quarterly training for everyone, not just in the restaurant industry, or is it that people get fired?
Oh, yeah. You know? Well, that should be part of the...
And we're talking... So far, we've, like, talked on the level of the celebrity.
Right.
You know, you were talking about 70% of this industry is women. Well, they're not mostly working in those restaurants that are going to get on James Beard Awards. Mm-hmm. You know? So who's looking out for them? And how do we deal with that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things, right? I think that we're seeing more and more chefs and restaurateurs turn over time with their staffs to trainings even before this started, whether it was about issues, whether it was about culture, right? Shift drink has now turned into shift coffee as we've been dealing with alcoholism and drug abuse in the industry, right? You know, the staff meal is being turned into opportunities to talk about the futures of restaurants. I mean, we are seeing so much proactive leadership and conversation. Now, whether that how that permeates across the board to those tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of eating establishments, some of that is going to have to be forced by law. I mean,
you're not going to get a universal change. I mean, Ruth, the answer is, I think up to this moment, literally, this is a straw, you know, breaking a camel's back. Previously, that might have been said that, you know, is this going to be the, you know, are we going to accept this? Clearly, it's not going to be accepted anymore. And I think what you...
I don't know that I know that.
Well, but I'm saying... Wait.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Let Daddy finish here.
Okay.
My point is, nothing is 100%. Nothing's universal. You're not going to have this wave of sensitivity wash over America, and everybody in every tasty diner or whatever in St. Louis is going to get the message and do it. But if people start doing it, it's not unlike...
Are you saying there'll be a trickle-down effect?
No, it's not a trickle. It's a wash-across effect. I think the more people who demand to be treated respectfully will beget more people being treated respectfully. But it's not going to be, you know, nobody's going to clap and,
well,
and, you
it's
know.
Not going to be overnight, but there does have to be systems put in place. And, you know, I think, Ruth, you bring up a lot of very good points because, you know, on the coast and in the bigger restaurants, there's way more room to have change. Right. People can be more demanding of it. I mean, especially on the East Coast, I mean, everybody's looking for front of the house, back of the house. I mean, you know, people are there's a lot of openings for jobs. So people who are trying to get those jobs can be more demanding in the kind of culture and work-life balance that really used to not go hand-in-hand with the restaurant industry at all. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the culture here. The question is, or not the question, but Catherine, you and I were talking about HR because, I mean, not all restaurant groups can afford an HR department. And you were talking about HR sharing.
Yeah. So what we've seen is that restaurants across spectrum, whether they be small, independent, or mid-sized restaurant groups who may not have resources for a ginormous HR department, right, actually pooling resources.
That's smart.
Right. Mm-hmm. So finding one HR consultant who's knowledgeable about the city or the state laws, because there's also, I mean, the thing about this, there's tons of rules, laws and regulations that protect workers. Right. And if businesses don't know those, you're actually putting your business at danger. Right. And if you're not regularly informing your employees and creating that culture where this stuff shouldn't happen and there are consequences for it happening. But a lot of folks don't have those resources. So one of the most innovative things that we've seen is actually HR sharing. There's, you know, an emergent, the Time's Up group has put together a legal defense fund, which includes restaurant workers and farm workers, which is really exciting. So mm-hmm. now if you want to file a case or want to go down the legal path for this stuff, there will be potentially resources available to support you in doing that, recognizing that the workers don't have those resources. So, I mean, this is two-tier for the employers and for the restaurateurs and the owners. Protecting your business is knowing the laws and getting the resources to help you build culture to do that. And
I mean, it's in your best interest.
It's in your best interest.
Right, as a business owner.
You know what? That's a great concept. I mean, we have a part-time bookkeeper who works for other businesses. Same thing.
Same thing, right? Yeah. And, you know, for the workers, it's making sure that they feel empowered and safe, but also providing them with the resources to protect themselves or pursue action if they don't feel protected. And so, you know, I think we're at an age where hopefully that community approach, right, that's not bosses over here and workers over here, but people coming together and building that culture together is hopefully where this is heading.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were also reading articles where people were proposing, you know, suggesting how this could be ameliorated in some way. And somebody made the point that, well, if you raise the wages of low-wage people, then they're less likely to be concerned about giving any crap back and crap is given and losing their job. They're going to be more fortified. But then you have the whole issue of, well, if you do that, then that $8 hamburger is going to be a $19 hamburger,
well,
et cetera.
Well, I think Ruth can speak to that. I mean, people have tried to get rid of tipping, and some people it's worked and some people it hasn't. It's a tough go.
I think that this is a whole separate thing. I personally don't think that the sexual harassment is tied to the level of wages.
Mm-hmm.
That's just
sexual harassment, but it's the willingness to take that shit because you have a low-paying job and you need it and you've got kids to feed.
Right, but if you're, as you said, if wages go up, everything else goes up, so mm-hmm. the wages tend to stay in the same realm regardless of whether, you know...
So that's not a solution.
So I don't think it's a solution. But so the idea, though, of having a fair wage is, I think, you know, should have been embraced years and years and years ago.
Right.
I mean, we were one of the we had health insurance before anybody else, and way before it was mandated and before many, many restaurants did. We've had sick leave. We have had a retirement package for a long, long time.
But I read, actually, that a lot of women-led businesses have those.
Right. Yes. I call it the feminization of the restaurant business.
Right.
So I don't
know. Because
you know,
it's what
we
want.
If we go back to, if there were more women in positions of ownership and being at the...
You could say power. We'll
okay,
go with power.
We like power.
We like power.
In the business, then some of these things might be more standardized.
Mm-hmm. You mean they're not going to question, like, why we should pay for maternity care and insurance and
well,
health insurance?
Anyway, we're not...
Sorry.
That's a whole nother...
I digress.
That's a whole nother thing. But I don't think it's. I think it's about self-worth. So when you talk about a low-paying position, you know, there are low-paid positions where the people in those positions feel valued, yeah, and have their own self feeling of self-worth, and they are going to do better in any kind of, you know,
work
difficult or abusive work environment than someone who doesn't. Changing the wage is not going
to
do it.
But I also think, and Catherine, I give this to both you, all of you here today. The question is we all know that we need more women in positions of power, whether it's in politics or finances, but also in the restaurant industry. And there's a lot of work to get more women running in politics. The question is how do we get more women in the industry and not starting at ground level?
We don't need to get them in the industry.
They're here, but how do we get them? Problem is that because they're not... But they're not getting the kind of attention they deserve. And it's not just writers not writing about them. They're not getting the money to open up the restaurants. There are too many blocks in front of them where men are, you know, like, look at the Cayman Islands this weekend. There's a huge event there this weekend. There is one woman chef. That's it. And it's like 15 men chefs. Yeah. It's so glaring. I can't even believe it. But my question is who we all need advocacy, and I don't know where to turn to for that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited because Ruth also sits on the advisory board for us for our Women's Entrepreneurial Leadership Program. So what we identified right at Beard was that it wasn't about bringing more women into the industry, because the majority of graduates from culinary school, the majority of small entrepreneurs building innovative businesses, all of that is being led by women. But Nikki, as you said, you know, they were missing access to capital because they're not in the same networks, right? Mm-hmm. They were missing some feeling of being able to negotiate. Right. One of the most badass women chefs I had ever met was like, I didn't know how to talk back to my contractor.
Right.
Right. About their build out. Right. So those types of things. So one is finding ways to mentor people. Right. So matching them with other chefs, other businesses that want to do the same thing. Some of that is providing them additional schooling. I mean, the other crazy thing about culinary school, no business classes in culinary school.
No business classes. Right. No sense.
It's like art school.
Well, you know what? A mentoring program. We have a friend who's a very successful baker who now has a very successful bakery, but her contractor was sticking it to her big time, and she was so frustrated because she wasn't getting any respect. So maybe part of it is also tutoring for, you know, women who want to become business owners and really don't know how to make the leap. I mean, Ruth, at some point you just said, "Fuck it, I'm going to go do it." Right?
I'm not sure that.
Did you
was
have
the
somebody?
Used,
the heck with it. You probably said the heck with it. But
no. I definitely.
That's my favorite adjective, adverb, pronoun, past pluperfect. But I mean, at some point
I was lucky. I mean, I had two, my parents, my mother was a housewife. And so she taught us about food, and she taught me to cook as a young girl. And my father was an entrepreneur. So I got both, you know, what you said about cooking school. I never went to cooking school, but I got both pieces just through, you know, having them as my parents.
Well, you were lucky.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, and
I was
fortunate.
Lucky. Fortunate. I was fortunate
in that respect.
Drew, tell us.
I think yes, more women in all of these positions. Yes, mentors. Ruth is very much one of those for me, and I can't tell you the list of reasons why that's been beneficial to me.
But you're really lucky.
I think the long term needs to be a conversation about the culture that we've created, and honestly, bringing men to the table.
Yeah,
since they're currently in a position of power, and if they were to use some of that power to empower women.
Right. I mean, it's enough with the time up button. It means nothing.
Yeah.
If you're not out speaking out about it and saying, you know, I'm not gonna take the 1.5 million when she's only getting 1,000. I mean, I'm going for pay equity. I'm going for the same level, and that goes across the board. Yeah. So I think you're spot on. Yeah. We have to bring, everybody has to come to the table.
This is a table of mostly women, and there's been glances and
David's here.
Chuckles, and we're all sort of on the same page.
I've let my feminine side out today.
Yes.
But, you know, one thing that was interesting, and it goes to women power voices, is that it immediately after this stuff started breaking, especially in culinary, I heard from probably 15 male chefs and restaurateurs about all the positive things they're doing in their kitchen. Right? Look at my mentor program.
Yep.
Look at the scholarship I've got, blah, blah, blah. Not one single female chef reached out proactively and said, hey, I've got a story I can tell about positive culture. And that was just, it wasn't, it's not, they just, like, we get shit
it's
done.
Just they,
like,
right.
It's just what yeah. we do.
Right. It's not right? a story to them.
And so part of it, you know, I was at a gathering in New York just last week, and part of it's like, we need help. At Beard, at Les Dames, at Women Chefs and Restaurateurs, all these places that can promote women to highlight that. It was one of the best things about Amanda's piece in Amanda Cohen's piece in Dirt Candy was she laid out 25 people that we should be paying attention to, right? So if there are great stories about female culture, female-run chefs and restaurateurs and restaurants, and that we can tell those stories about culture, I think trying to push that out, because I heard from every notable male chef about some initiative they were about to launch.
Yeah, but don't you feel like instead of a Me Too, that was a not me? Like,
yeah, totally.
Not me.
I had a conversation recently with an older man who was talking about his business, and he was like, somebody could just say, you know, 30 years ago, I was inappropriate with
Amen.
Her, right? And he was like, I'm freaked out. And my response, I actually did not say this to him, so I'm saying it to everybody.
Okay.
My response is that's the fear that women live with all the time.
And I will amen
you
that.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I'm fine with him being a little afraid. And mm-hmm. if we can talk more about it and get it out there more and more and more, so more men will think more about what it is they're doing, from just being slightly inappropriate to true abuse.
Right.
You know, it all...
They teach it to you in preschool. Keep your hands to yourself. That's what they tell you. Hands belong on your body. Right?
Well, but Louis C.K. had his hands to himself, and he still was inappropriate. So.
That's also true.
And that's the end of the show. Actually, it is. We got to kind of wrap up.
Yeah,
so.
We do. Oh, my God. I want to thank you all for joining us today. This was such a really good talk. I mean, there is no answer yet, but I feel like we're by all working together, we can come up with changes in this culinary industry, and we cannot let it die. It's got to go past Me Too. It's got to go at Time's Up. We have to have our voices heard, and we need to find ways to work together and bring the men in and change the culture of how men and women work together, not just in our industry, but in all the industries.
Don't look at me. I'm working with you.
I know you're working with me.
Terrified of you. All right. So next week, actually, Drew, the fermented beverages you brought in are apropos for next week's subject. Because
yes.
We're going to be talking about fermentation.
Yes. Next week, we're going to go a little lighter, literally. We'll be talking about...
Thank God. I'm exhausted. No, I'm sitting here.
Poor David's
Can
sweating.
I take my seatbelt off?
We have the team from Hex Ferments. So they do fabulous kombuchas.
That sounded like Hex for Men. Hex Ferments.
Ferments.
Okay.
Hex Ferments.
That's a New Jersey.
Yeah, it's a Jersey girl, MA. So they do fabulous kombuchas and kimchis and sauerkrauts that are filled with all these nutritious and fabulous probiotics. And we're going to learn all about what these fermented foods do for you. And they're bringing in a cocktail person because a little booze in there doesn't hurt either.
I don't even know what a probiotic is. I thought it's different than an amateur biotic.
Okay.
I have no...
On that lovely note,
I
yes,
got two
but
laughs.
I'm big.
Drew's right? looking at me like, you are an asshole. But I got two laughs. I'll take
okay. it. Okay. Anyway, thank you, Ruth, Catherine, Drew. Thank you all for joining us today. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. You find us here every Friday night live at the Line Hotel.
No, thanks every for- Monday night.
Monday night. What did I say?
Friday night.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.